I'm taking a slightly different approach than I've ever taken at APHA, and I'm going really for theory today, so I hope you don't mind that. This is going to be a fairly theoretical paper that I'm presenting on two research studies that I did, and I'm arguing for methodology here. So my recent research has been concerned with the intersection of local-level implementation of higher-level policies and projects, and I've identified a common theme in analyzing local-level processes that is applicable to health development and sustainable local change. This discussion will differentiate between assets-based and needs-based approaches and community participation versus community agency. As healthcare policy is being organized at higher levels with the global health policies of multilateral institutions and substantially funded public-private partnerships, understanding how global-level health discourse affects local-level healthcare and population health is imperative. I question here, if it'll let me, I question here how can global health policies and agendas be successfully translated for local level use? I skipped. Okay, I'm sorry. That's this one. Sorry. Okay. This has been questioned by the so-called post-development theorists who believe that development interventions in low-income countries cannot escape from a paradigm which is Eurocentric, teleological, and modernist. Matthew states, what distinguishes the post-development perspective from other critical perspectives is that post-development theory pronounces the demise of development and urges for alternatives to development rather than alternative development. This rejection of the entire paradigm of development is a mere dismissal without any attempt at a replacement or modified paradigm. However, criticism without alternatives is highly unsatisfactory. Hence, the post-development theorists are proposing that it is not the answer that needs to be modified, but that an answer that does not take into account the context dependency of experiences, needs, and aspirations of those it claims to assist is the wrong answer for addressing deprivation and disparity at the local levels. Hence, although we speak of a globalized world, we live in a localized world that is socially constructed and context dependent. Hence, the post-development critique cannot simply be dismissed as a fad, but must be attended to beyond mere criticism, and is very, very relevant to international health interventions. Central to this issue is the community participation discourse. The community participation discourse literature was markedly unsatisfactory and contradictory as I did a review of it. From the criticisms of participation as tyranny to Cleaver's assessment that there is little evidence of long-term effectiveness of participation in materially improving the conditions of the most vulnerable people or as a strategy for social change. Participation has therefore become an act of faith in development and in healthcare interventions. Sorry. Something we believe in, but we rarely question and we rarely assess. Paul's assessment for the World Bank found the indiscriminate use of community participation in all types of projects is completely unwarranted by the World Bank. Deschler and Schock distinguish genuine participation, which can include either citizen control or cooperation, with a delegated power or partnership agreements between citizens and agencies, from pseudo-participation, which can include placation, consultation or information without power sharing, as well as manipulation. In general, terms such as participation, empowerment, and capacity building have become buzzwords for project implementation that in representing everything, they appear to represent nothing. But all share a common connotation that something is being done to a community, with community members, for their own betterment, as primarily determined by outside experts, resulting in a conundrum that smacks of the Foucauldian conception of institutionalized power. For the participation discourse, control remains external to the community, or to most members of the community. According to Cleaver, empowerment is an especially problematic concept, for it is often unclear who exactly is being empowered, the individual, the community, the poor. Furthermore, the question of how such categories might exercise agency is often sidestepped. In many policy documents, an apolitical individualization of this concept is identified, whereby the individual is expected to take opportunities offered by health and development projects to better themselves and the development of the community. Participation is far from always empowering. More fundamentally, however, we have the problem of defining a community. Is it an arbitrary administrative, political, or project construction for the purposes of designating a population for implementation, or is it defined by the population itself? Jackson et al.'s definition of community capacity offers an alternative to the community participation discourse as the potential of a community to build on its strengths in order to achieve its goals. This begins to redress the importance of the assets already occurring within a group rather than what is externally determined to be needed by the group. In a needs-based approach, the assessment concerns what is wrong with a given group. By asking what is wrong, a methodology is automatically set in motion, which presumes that knowledge of wrong and right is solely the domain of the external expert who has the solution, intervention to rectify what they determine to be wrong. Although participation may modify what is right or how exactly the intervention is implemented and who does it, right and wrong, which normatively follows a modernist paradigm, are still external to most groups. An assets-based approach, however, assesses what answers already lie within a community. Hence, solutions do not need to be imposed externally. In this case, the expert facilitates the understanding of what is already present in any given context. In order to attempt to address this challenge, I reviewed research I had conducted at the local level in neighboring communities in two quite different contexts. First, in 12 neighboring Guatemalan communities investigating intractable chronic malnutrition, and in 16 different communities of four municipalities investigating healthcare decentralization and the effect of the work of bottom-up community health workers. As a disclaimer, I must add that although I fully agree with Cleaver's critique of the concept of community, that there is a strong assumption in interventions that there is one identifiable community in any location, and that there is a coterminosity between natural resource, social, and administrative boundaries, I will abide by the normative designations for the local cases I will not present. So, this doesn't like me, does it? So with an assets-based approach, we begin with malnutrition in Guatemala. Indigenous Guatemala displays the poorest values for chronic malnutrition in the Western Hemisphere. Using the indicator of stunting, which in itself is a debatable indicator, but unfortunately beyond the confines of this presentation, if dark green here represents, If dark green represents chronic malnutrition on this map, you can only see dark green in the Western Hemisphere right here in the region of Guatemala. Our research asks why, after 50 years of interventions, and you see again here, Guatemala has the worst stunting for the Western Hemisphere, and also underweight is one of the poorest values. Why, after 50 years of interventions, did Guatemala maintain the highest prevalence of chronic malnutrition with the lowest and slowest reductions in the Western Hemisphere? I led a group of 8 researchers in which we had 6 weeks to investigate 12 communities around Lake Atitlan, which is a very beautiful lake. It was an extremely rich selection because even though these communities were neighboring, each one was unique with a different dialect and also a different traditional dress or traje from one to the next. We conducted various types of quantitative and qualitative assessments, but I'll just focus on two. Community perceptions, practices, and preferences revealed a diet high in carbohydrates, specifically corn and corn products, and low in protein. However, in general, there was a tendency for both municipal leaders and representatives, such as medical practitioners and NGO workers, to blame the community's perceptions and practices as the primary cause of their malnutrition, rather than to structure sustainable solutions. There was an exhibited tendency to view the community members as the problem, and that word was used quite often in the interviews I had. They are the problem. And not to consider the intervention or the interventionists as possibly contributing to these challenges. Thereby, the actual ideological factors may never be identified or resolved. Similarly, communities complain that NGOs neither communicated nor coordinated properly with communities, and that interventions did not target the neediest and were essentially not effective. The importance of this critique of needs-based approaches can be illustrated by a schematic representation using multidimensional scaling of pile sorts of a comparison of domain analyses of pile sorts conducted by NGOs and pile sorts conducted by community members concerning the domain of food. Multidimensional scaling of the patterns of the groupings of 23 items related to food reveal a value system, and these were mostly European and American, North American students that were working at these NGOs. So these groupings in biomedical groupings such as sugars, carbohydrates, proteins, etc. And it's laid out, and I color-coded it so you could see how it's laid out. And I don't know if you've ever done multidimensional scaling, but you can't really get your thing in there. It's really pile source and multidimensional scaling provide a real foolproof way of doing qualitative research where you're not putting your own spin on it. This, however, and compare these two. This, however, is from the community members. And the community members basically had a valueless understanding of food as everything was really piled together here in the multidimensional scaling, where all food was considered good and divided only according to what goes well with bread, what I eat versus what my child eats, etc. Such vastly different conceptions of food, as illustrated here, cannot help but problematize healthcare interventions where the interventionists in the community are essentially speaking different languages. That said, were myriad other factors external to the community, such as these small tiendas that popped up after Hurricane Mitch, that provided no protein and were basically, just as you see here, snack foods. One of the methods that we used was a positive devious approach. Positive deviance is an assets-based approach in which members of a group are distinguished according to who is thriving along a given criterion in which the rest of the group is not. Hence, the solution already lies within the group. Ideally, the given group identifies what is the criterion and what they consider to be the positive value. For example, in one of the early uses of positive deviance for Save the Children International, researchers found that in one Vietnamese community, one family's babies were better nourished because the mother simply picked an extra piece of shrimp or two for her children while she was in the field. Hence, the child had more protein. Hence, you do not require Nestle's coming in with a multi-million-dollar baby formula project. So in these three steps, a positive deviance approach can be successfully established. You identify the positive deviant or the person or persons who are thriving in a community where others are not thriving along that criterion. Identify what they are doing differently that is facilitating their positive deviant status and assist them in teaching this deviant action to other community members. Our positive deviant case family was headed by a single mother of three teenagers, all who displayed positive anthropometric values and were not stunted. What was noteworthy was that what the mother did not do in her child rearing. She did not wean the children with sugar or water or coffee or Coca-Cola, as was common in these communities, but with a vitamin-fortified cereal in Caparina. She kept little sugar or coffee in the house, and the children were not given funds to buy snack foods from the tiendas, thus they had to come home for a full meal. But most significantly, she did not conform to a common attitude found in many of these communities that could be best described as circumstantial determinism, whereby informants given circumstances were perceived as being meant to be as they are, and thereby unalterable. Rather, this informant displayed marked agency in both her actions and her attitude towards her life and her children's lives. Since 1991, healthcare in the Philippines has been decentralized to the local administrative unit known as the barangay, part as a result of the contingencies of World Bank and IMF loans, but rationalized by the Aquino administration as the opposite approach of the Marcos administration, with healthcare now being in the hands of the people. However, no two communities in any municipality in the Philippines are equivalent, and few have the financial or knowledge resources to be responsible for healthcare in their communities. Hence, healthcare now lay in empty hands. Barangay healthcare was administrated by a midwife, but the basic unit of healthcare was delivered by the Department of Health trained barangay members known as barangay health workers, who were minimally compensated for their time. Devolution has resulted in markedly increased health disparity in this context. As illustrated here in the municipality of Mercia, you can see that a higher percentage of reported increased cost of biomedicine on the bottom line, the lowest use of biomedicine in this community compared to the others, or municipality, next line up, and the highest reported use of traditional medicine of these basically socioeconomically similar municipalities. In general, higher out-of-pocket expenditures for healthcare in brown, with a basically unchanged public healthcare expenditure in red, has further increased healthcare disparity along with devolution. In Mercia, an NGO called ENAM trained community health workers in both basic biomedical preventative healthcare measures as well as in local use of herbs that the positive deviants in the community were using with success, resembling the volunteer lay community barefoot doctors of China. Since the inception of this bottom-up program 3 years ago, there has been a slight reduction in morbidity and mortality reported in Mercia. Mercia's community members displayed a marked eagerness for change and the initiative to execute change that was not as evident in other barangays. Furthermore, leadership, I should say other municipalities, furthermore, leadership in Mercia was individually motivated and horizontally coordinated. Lastly, a strong identity displayed in these barangays helped to facilitate the receptivity of barangay members to these community health workers. In conclusion, these cases identified certain common traits that included community leadership, communication, I have to whiz through these, cooperation, coordination. All of these traits are shared in these communities. Leadership appears especially important to foster. Hence, I argue that what all of these communities in these two country case examples display is not community participation as much as community agency. Newman and Dale pose it that agency facilitates and increase access to critical forms of capital in order for individuals or groups to overcome barriers and solve problems. Thereby, community agency facilitated through an assets-based approach, such as positive deviance, may offer a resolution to the unsuccessful top-down healthcare intervention dilemma that is often seen in many low-income country interventions. Hence, I am proposing that just as the positive deviant intervention individual can provide answers to context-dependent challenges, so too can a positive deviant community generate potential solutions and thereby context-dependent interventions for neighboring communities. These communities can demonstrate community agency in which interventions are community-initiated, community-controlled, and community-sustained, as distinct from externally initiated, controlled, and sustained community participation, which by its very paternal nature renders the community into a more passive role at best. Hence, I argue that community agency, fostered through an assets-based approach, such as positive deviance, can offer resolution to both the post-development riddle that I showed you in the beginning, and facilitate context-dependent healthcare interventions that better offer opportunities for sustainable health at local levels. Thank you for your attention.